Welcome. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. So here we are, 47 days away from the November general election. Here in Michigan, the political races have some competition in the headlines with the box. The box you're supposed to tick off to declare that, yes, you are an American citizen. Michigan's Secretary of State Ruth Johnson instructed local election clerks to include that question on ballot applications, the ones where we list our name, address, and date of birth. That decree has sparked a lawsuit and some outright defiance on the part of some clerks who are refusing to use ballot applications with the citizenship question. We're joined now by Secretary of State Ruth Johnson. Secretary Johnson, this week you were sued by a coalition of unions, civil rights groups, and voters over those instructions that voters who show up at the polls on Election Day should be asked whether they are a U.S. citizen. What do you say to critics who say this is voter suppression?
Yeah, we did this in February and May and didn't have any problems at all. And then, of course, in August, a couple people didn't want to fill it out to show their displeasure with it. But really, it's nothing unusual. We have a universal federal postcard ballot application, and our military has to fill it out, and they have to fill in an oval that says, I'm a U.S. citizen, and sign it also. It was done in 2002 in Michigan because we do have a problem here. We have some new data that's confirmed that we have as many as 4,000 non-citizens on our voter rolls, and that's because the federal government required Michigan for over 30 years to ask everyone when they came in for a driver's license or a personal identification if they'd like to register to vote. English often not being their first language, people signed up, got their voter registration in the card and then in the mail and then thought it was acceptable to vote. So we know we have about 4,000 based on the fact that we've collected data on 19% as they come in over the last few years, 19% of our non-citizens. We took that data, and it was very arduous, had to go through each one individually, and that was over 50,000, and found that we have 963 non-citizens that are registered to vote, and some of them have voted. And if you take that, that's about one-fifth, and times it by five, which is reasonable, and that's a pretty good sample. It means that we have probably over 4,000 non-citizens registered to vote. And some people say, well, that's not that many, but I beg to differ. Five House seats in Michigan's primary last month were decided by fewer than 100 votes. And a recent congressional race in 2010 was decided in the primary by 15 votes. So every vote does count.
So clearly you feel there's a lot of housekeeping that needs doing when you look at Michigan's voter rolls.
Right.
Well, I'm wondering if the box is not mandatory, which you've made clear it's not mandatory. If you don't check it, you're still allowed to vote. How does it really help people who legally shouldn't vote from voting?
And that's why it's not the number one way to do it. The number one way is for the federal government. But I've written a letter to Homeland Security. I visited them in D.C. I wrote a letter to Social Security Administration and the president. They all refuse to help. So is this ideal? No. But we believe that most of the people that are voting because they were asked and they received a voter card in the mail and it's mistaken. We do not believe that this is some kind of, you know, effort to that has been organized to have non-citizens vote. So most people are going to react to the honor system and do the right thing once they know it's a felony. So we think this will take care of the majority of the people. We still need the federal government to stand up and do the right thing and help us get those folks off the voter roll so it doesn't hurt them. And it also doesn't, you know, have the potential to change the outcome of a race.
Well, now you've got, Secretary Johnson, you've got some clerks around the state flat out refusing to use the applications that have the citizenship box. In your mind, what should be done about these clerks that are saying, no, we're not going to do it?
Well, in Macomb County, if you take a look, if you look at the 80 people that we found that are non-citizens, some of them have voted in you, then times five, because we have one-fifth of the data, that's about 400 non-citizens that are probably registered in Macomb County. That's information the clerk did not have when they made these decisions. And, you know, the clerks that have said that we have in our database that people from their communities are not citizens. And I don't think this should be a partisan issue. It's a common sense issue. If you're not a citizen, you should not be voting in federal elections against the law, the Constitution, and our American way. My dad was an immigrant, and immigration's made us a very strong superpower with high quality of life. and people have to wait in line and work hard to become citizens, and then they earn the right to vote.
Have you had conversations with Governor Snyder about this, especially in light of the new data? Because I know he vetoed the bill that would have made that citizenship box law. Have you had conversations?
Yeah, I did it in February and May as sort of a pilot, and then I wanted to codify it into law. And he did veto it as far as being codified, but we're continuing based on that. And I had a brief conversation with him before he got on the plane to China.
Okay.
But it's too close to the election now to probably start new legislation. It takes a while to get through. So we'll continue to request our local and city township clerks to include the ballot box, you know, elaborate on the application under Michigan law MCL 168.31E, which gives me the authority to prescribe the forms.
All right. You're just back from a trip to the Middle East, meeting with the military men and women, trying to smooth the way for them to be able to vote in the November general election. What did you accomplish with the trip?
Well, first of all, it was week-long. We had to leave a day early, 24 hours early. We had 25 minutes to get ready. But I was really honored to be selected to be part of the work that I've already done as part of Operation Our Troops Count back here at home. We've done many new laws in Michigan that really help. Now the military can order their ballots online. They can register online. If they're overseas, they can find their local clerk, request an absentee ballot, and see a sample ballot, and then track their ballot, too. And there were five of us that went, and we visited numerous military installations and embassies. We had shipboard visits in Kuwait, Bahrain, and we call it Qatar. They call it Qatar. And I took almost 50 pounds worth of cards and flags over there, and on the deck of cards, we wrote, "Our troops count because your vote is a big deal." And then on the back of it, we have our website where they can do all those things. And the new law says that even for a local election, they can write it on a scrap piece of paper and send it in.
Because I know some of those folks got missed in the primary, didn't they? Because some 70 clerks missed the deadlines to get the absentee ballots to those military.
None of them were missed because how many days they were late, it was extended. Plus, Michigan is a little more technologically advanced than a lot of the states because we now allow the military to request their ballots online, and they get it then sent to them online. So that saves 10 to 14 days, but 95% of the clerks got out their military ballots on time. Some of them did not get it out on Friday and waited till Monday, so we expanded the time that they would count the votes 3 days past the election for our military to make sure every single military person that voted had an opportunity to have their voice heard, to have their ballot counted.
Speaking of lines, we actually, Secretary Johnson, put it up on our Facebook page asking if any of our listeners had questions for you. I'm going to leave you with this comment from listener Constance Miller on Facebook, who said to me, "Just tell her the office on Sashabaugh is fast and very friendly."
So proud of our staff. They're doing a great job out there, and it really has been a joy to work with them.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson. Thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Between the Canadian Auto Workers Union and GM and Chrysler, with Ford having reached a tentative but not yet ratified contract agreement with the CAW. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton's here to update us on the talks. Tracy, Ford put itself in a pretty good position by reaching an agreement first.
It did. Ford has the smallest footprint of the Detroit Three in Canada, so financially there's not as much at stake for them to meet the union halfway, and that indeed is what they did. They backed off from demanding the same kind of semi-permanent lower wage for new hires that the UAW has in the U.S., and they agreed just to lower the Canadian starting wage, and then they extended the period of time it takes for a worker to get up to that full wage to 10 years. So they agreed to something that could be more expensive for GM and Chrysler to match, and that gives them a competitive advantage.
And then for GM, how close is their agreement?
Well, until this morning, we thought they were pretty close, but now the union says there's an impasse. impasse over a planned layoff of 2,000 workers in Oshawa next year. Okay. They say GM isn't willing to match the Ford deal, so they're rattling the sabers. They say the Windsor Star just reported that the union says we're going to issue a 24-hour strike notice if we don't get what we want within the hour.
Okay.
Just remember that may be rattling sabers. It may be just a way of increasing the pressure on GM.
And Canada and Ontario, we need to remind everyone, actually played a part in GM's bailout.
They sure did. The two governments combined contributed $1.7 billion to the bailout. So even though the companies might talk about, well, we'll pull out of Canada if we don't get what we want, I think that would be politically inexpedient and it might sort of hurt their image with Canadian customers.
Yes, indeed. And as for Chrysler, tell us how much is at stake for Chrysler if its Canadian operations were to be disrupted?
Chrysler probably has the most at stake here. They have the largest footprint. About 30% of their North American production comes from Canada, including basically all the minivans that they make come from Canada. So that's a big source of profit for them, and they really need to preserve that profit.
Overall, until perhaps some of this latest news coming out of the GM talks, how's the tenor of the talks been? Has there been a lot of saber rattling until today?
Yeah. initially, there usually is, and there was. Mm-hmm. The union said, we are not going to give any concessions at all. And Sergio Marchionne said, I have to have that two-tier wage system that the UAW has. Then it settled down. Now we have some more. It's pretty typical, really.
It's typical. Well, Tracy Sambleton, Michigan Radio's Autobeat reporter, keeping a close eye on the contracts hawks in Toronto. Thanks, Tracy.
You're welcome.
And still to come on Stateside, we're going to find out why the president of the University of Michigan is packing her bags for Brazil. We'll look at movies, art, pianos, and Michigan wine. What's not to love? And find out how an army of angels with tools has changed the lives of a military family in White Lake Township. Those stories and more straight ahead on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When Time magazine declares that you're one of the 10 best college presidents in the nation, when the president of the United States turns to you for advice on boosting America's manufacturing capability, you are someone who is truly making an impact. That someone is the president of the University of Michigan, Mary Sue Coleman. This coming Saturday, she's headed to Brazil for a busy, busy week of meetings and working sessions. President Coleman, why Brazil?
Well, you know, what we've tried to do over my tenure at the university is to pick places in the world for me to go with a small delegation that will enrich experiences that our students can have and that our faculty can have. And so about a year ago, a faculty group looking around the world, I'd been to China and to South Africa, recommended to me that my next trip be to Brazil. We already have a number of research projects with faculty in Brazil. We already have Brazilian students, and we have our students going to Brazil, and it's a rapidly developing economy. And so I took their recommendation, and I'm going Saturday.
So what do you hope will come out of this nearly week that you're going to be spending there?
It will be a wonderful opportunity for me to highlight the work that is already occurring, for us to listen to colleagues in Brazil. We find that these trips are mutually interesting. They have good ideas. We have good ideas. And I hope to provide more opportunities for collaboration and for our students and to attract some students from Brazil to come to University of Michigan. We already have a number, but we'd like to provide more opportunity.
What is it that these students coming in from Brazil to the Ann Arbor campus and to Michigan, what do they bring to the table, if you will, and what does it mean to the average Michigan kid?
You know, in a rapidly developing economy like Brazil, I think students bring us perspective that is quite interesting. I mean, the issues that Brazil is facing, sustainability, some areas of medical research, Brazilian history and tradition, you know, those are intriguing topics and ones that we have great expertise, but we've also been interested in Brazil from our perspective, too. So I think having more students come simply provides an opportunity for us to provide global opportunities for our students to get interested. It is really what makes Michigan a very special place.
You became the president of the University of Michigan. It was the spring of 2002, and no one really had that crystal ball and a way of knowing that the Great Recession was going to slam hard just a few short years later, and especially in our state. the recession driving down middle-class incomes and driving up demand for financial aid, right at the time that the state aid was drying up. How do you think you and your team at U of M did in navigating some very choppy waters?
I'm very proud of what we've accomplished, not only to keep the University of Michigan strong during this very difficult time. We've ramped up financial aid so much. We found ways to cut our cost. We have balanced this, I think, with enormous skill, and it's because I have really, really good people at so many levels around the university, all working in concert to keep the university strong, not just to keep it strong, but make it better and better and provide opportunity for students. When I look at the types of financial aid that we're able to offer today that we couldn't have even dreamed about 10 years ago, I'm just really proud. Our donors have stepped up. You know, all parts of this puzzle have to work together
yes.
To do what we've done at the university. So I'm very proud of my colleagues.
I'd like to get your thoughts, if I might, on a very typical story in our state. Kids graduating from college, it could be U of M, it could be MSU, Eastern, Western, the smaller colleges, and they graduate with large student loan debt, and then the outlook in terms of jobs is not real optimistic for a lot of these youngsters. Does it raise a question about the value of a university degree?
One of the things that I've been so proud about, and I think that there are some misconceptions about the debt that students graduate with, at least at the University of Michigan, students, and we only look at the students who take loans. I mean, we don't, you know, not averaging this over students who don't take loans. Mm-hmm. So the average debt is, you know, somewhere between $22,000 and $25,000, and that's manageable. It's certainly manageable. We're working really hard to reduce that loan burden, but we understand that it's still there. From my perspective, a college education, if a student's interested, and, you know, everybody isn't interested, and that's fine, provides you with opportunities in life and options in life that are simply, you know, unparalleled. And so I would encourage young people, if they have an interest, to certainly seek a college degree, university degree. I believe in this day and age, we all need to work hard to keep the debt burden manageable, and that's certainly something that we're going to do at the University of Michigan. But for me, a college education was so intrinsically valuable to me because it opened up my mind to a world that I wouldn't have known existed if it weren't for that discipline of mind, learning about other parts of the world, learning my own discipline. And so I think it's an aspiration that I hope we still keep in the United States.
President Coleman, your contract is up in 2014. What do you most want to accomplish as president of the University of Michigan before you decide whether it's time to do something different? Summarize your vision for us.
Well, you know, we have been on such a path here to create opportunities for students, to have our programs that are recognized worldwide, to keep moving ahead, to provide opportunities that are almost unparalleled, I believe, in higher education. When a student comes to Michigan, that student can study almost anything imaginable because we have the breadth and depth of scholarly work here that it continues to amaze me. And people see the facilities, but, you know, the facilities are just facilities. It's the people inside that make all the difference. And so I hope that I can look back on my own tenure and say, you know, the University of Michigan has become more prominent, more relevant, more critical to the success of this state than when I came. And I really feel that so passionately, and I have so much work to get done in the next 2 years that it's going to be a marathon, but I'm really excited about it.
Including packing for your trip to Brazil, leaving this Saturday.
That's right.
Thank you so much for spending time with us, and we'll look forward to checking in and talking with you when you get back from Brazil.
I look forward to that, too. Thanks so much.
President Mary Sue Coleman, University of Michigan. Will go down as an annus horribilis for most fruit growers in Michigan. Apples, cherries, pears, they were all hit hard by that big March warm-up we had, then the spring frost, and then that hot, dry summer. But if you're a wine producer in Michigan, you might be feeling a little happier about the weather we've had this year. Eddie O'Keefe is the president of Chateau Grand Traverse Wines on Old Mission Peninsula. Eddie, what has the challenging weather meant for Michigan's wineries?
Well, I tell you, it's a lot of nail biting early in the spring with the crazy warm temperatures, and then to follow it up literally from 90 degrees to 3 feet of snow on the ground a few days later. Sometimes what might be our detriment is sometimes our benefit. And in this particular case this year, because where we grow our grapes is in very well-draining soil, it's very sandy, gravelly, we didn't really have much in the way of standing water in our vineyards after it warmed up and froze. And so therefore, there was nothing to freeze. And so our vines were pretty much in good shape. And then as we approached springtime, there was a lot of nail biting again, because it could have at any time all the way through almost the end of May, it could have frozen or frosted.
And
we just never quite got there. So we eked it out and made it through spring without really any issues.
And then the summer with the hot, dry weather, is that better for you than rainy weather?
Well, yes and no. Hot, dry weather, that develops the sugar in the grapes, but if it goes for an extended period of time, the grapes will eventually just shut down. They will do nothing. When you get temperatures above 90, the vines just kind of go into a survival mode. So really below 90, ample rain and so forth is what we need. Luckily, we got some decent rain early in the year, and that's held us on fairly well. But now we are getting to the point where we really could use rain. So we didn't have any frost damage. We made it through the summer so-called drought, but really some rain at this point would be very helpful.
Now, Eddie, you said the sugars kind of increase in the grapes. Does that mean that the wine you're going to be able to make from those grapes is actually maybe a little bit better?
Well, there's never an easy answer in winemaking. And to give you an idea, warm weather develops sugar, and cooler weather or cooler evenings maintain the acidity of the fruit. And just to give you an idea, if you bite into an unripe apple, that's acidity. If you bite into an overripe apple, that's sugar. So you want to find it right at that midpoint. And the warm weather develops sugar. The cool weather pretty much maintains the acidity. And that's kind of where we're trying to find the balance.
And keeping your fingers crossed. So it kind of sounds like you're saying, yeah, it's been a good year, but you don't want to jinx it.
Yes, I don't want to jinx it. If I were just to give a blanket statement, I think this is going to be an excellent year, especially for red wines and richer wines such as Chardonnay. And the warm weather will give wines with a lot of body. With regard to the traditional wines that we produce, such as Riesling and things like that, it will be a very good year for late harvest and sweeter style wines. The crisper, lighter style wines might not be the best this year. I'm certainly not saying they're going to be bad, but they're not going to be at their optimum.
Eddie, I got to ask you, because I know a lot of friends, I know a lot of people who really do love wines. How did you come to be the president of a winery? Where did this all begin for you?
My father, who's a very entrepreneurial, spirited guy, who's been everything from a gym teacher to an insurance salesman to a FBI agent to a Green Beret Army paratrooper, decided he wanted to go in the wine business back in the early 70s, and decided on northern Michigan, where he thought grapes would grow. And to make a long story short, most experts in the universities and everybody said, you cannot grow grapes in northern Michigan. And lo and behold, that's what an entrepreneur needs to hear, that you can't do something. So he started a winery where none existed. And today, gal, in Traverse City area, there's nearly 30 wineries up here. But anyways, I had to follow my father up here, and I went away to college like anybody else and worked in some other areas. But I came back here and started at the winery back in 1985, and we were a very, very small winery at that point, probably about 4,000 cases, 5,000 cases of production. And it's just the idea of you work with it, keep growing year after year incrementally, and this year we're probably anticipated to produce about 110,000 cases of product.
Which one are you most excited about, Eddie, of your
Well, some of the red wines from 2011 have yet to be bottled, and they are going to be excellent. And as far as from the wines this year, we have a Gamay, which is a red wine variety, which is a French red, which will be excellent. And, of course, always look for the late harvest Riesling. It should be one of the best years ever.
Love Riesling. I love hearing you say that. Eddie O'Keefe, much success, and thank you so much for sharing some insight into the wine industry here in our state at Chateau Grand Traverse, right there on the beautiful Old Mission Peninsula. Thanks so much, Eddie.
Thank you.
People are making a lot of movies about Detroit these days, and more than 60 of them will be screened this weekend at an outdoor film festival on the city's east side. Organizers are hoping to spark conversation about exactly how Detroit is seen by Michiganders and the rest of the world. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia has more.
25 hours, 15 minutes, and 45 seconds of film, documentaries, music videos, all about Detroit.
It's kind of wild how many have been made in the last 3 or 4 years. I wasn't aware that it was on this scale.
Nicole McDonald was born and raised in Detroit. Her documentary, A City to Yourself, will be in the festival.
The houses stand empty or have a fire. You wind up with this strangely shaped neighborhood.
A lot of the films are what you'd expect. They're stories of abandonment, stories about crime. But there are also stories about Detroit's pride.
There ain't no party like a Detroit party, and a Detroit party don't stop. Go!
And some of the bizarre side of the city, too.
You can't have a theme park in a residential area.
The festival is all of these images put together in one place.
We've sort of made a cocktail, but we don't know what it's going to taste like.
Anya Sirota is an architect at the University of Michigan, and she's one of the festival's organizers. She says the event is kind of like a neighborhood block party, with some movies, food, music. But instead of DJs, they'll have discourse jockeys who'll move around the crowd, getting conversation going about the images people are seeing.
We've put in some ingredients. We've invited some people. They all have different perspectives. We don't know what the resultant conversation is going to be.
This whole idea started because international filmmakers from Paris and London were coming in to make movies about the city. But Detroiters weren't getting to see them.
For about a year now, we've been working on a project called Detroit Je T'aime. That's French for Detroit, I love you.
Detroit was one of the first Western cities to go through a dramatic economic downturn.
Detroit is such a mirror that reflects back what one wants to see.
Mireille Rodier is another architect and festival organizer.
And in that sense, you know, the productions that come from California are so very optimistic. The reflections that come from Europe are obsessed with the fall of capitalism in a very most predictable way. The reflections that come from Detroiters are very much about pride.
But the festival's organizers aren't just going to watch the movies. As architects and urban designers, they're going to mine those films for data. They want to know who's making those images, what parts of the city are represented most, and what kind of city do those movies reflect.
We want the community to see how their city has been represented through both locals and international voices and faces.
That's James Chestnut. He's an architecture student at the University of Michigan. He's also my partner, by the way. Like the other organizers, he doesn't know if residents are going to show up. But there is at least one local who'll be there. Ralph LaViolette lives near Detroit's east side. He says movies about Detroit matter.
I think what they see and what they take pictures of out of reality. And this is just the way it is. A lot of us, you know, we don't want to accept the truth.
The film festival Imaging Detroit runs Friday through Saturday in Detroit's Parian Park. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
Here at Stateside, we want to be in touch with you. What's going on in your community? What stories do you want to hear? Find us online at michiganradio.org, where, of course, you can find past shows and past interviews. Or go to Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Still to come, Art Prize 2012 has only been open for one day in Grand Rapids. And already one of the artists has gone too far for one of the host businesses with an effigy of Saddam Hussein hanging from a noose. Is that art? We're going to find out as we talk to Art Prize founder Rick DeVos. That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Art Prize 2012 has opened in Grand Rapids. It's the fourth time round for the huge art exhibition and contest. This year, more than 1,500 artists are competing for $560,000 in prize money. And it is all there, from art that inspires to art that could outrage. And it certainly does get folks talking. Art Prize founder Rick DeVos joins us now from Grand Rapids. Rick, you get literally hundreds of thousands of people coming to view the art in Grand Rapids every year. But a lot of our Southeast Michigan listeners might well hear art, and the first thing they might think of could be the Ann Arbor Art Fairs. So would you tell us how Art Prize differs from shows like Ann Arbor's?
Well, it's not specifically a marketplace. So it's not a lot of work, you know, that is for sale at an art fair. You could purchase and go home with that day, potentially. There are things on the sides of buildings here. There are things in the river. So it's not specifically a marketplace, although artists can and do sell work. But the main difference is it's an art prize competition. So and that significant amount of those prizes is actually allocated based on public vote.
So tell us how the popular voting works.
Yeah, so it really works in two stages. And the background on this is I originally looked at doing a film festival, and they're so democratic, and people kind of vote with their butts in the seats for the various screenings. You
so
know, there's
true.
A hot ticket that you try and get into.
Sure.
So I wanted to at an event with that same sort of spirit and that common platform that everybody could engage with each other. So how it works is you actually register with us on artprize.org. You have to actually activate in person. We have registration stations in the 3-square-mile area of Grand Rapids, that is like the district. Or if you download one of our smartphone apps, you can actually activate when you're in the district based on GPS location technology. So once you're activated, you can vote for the first week and a half, essentially. You can vote for as many things as you want. So let's say you see 200 pieces, you think 5 of them are worthy of recognition, you can vote for each one of those. At the end of that first week and a half, we cut it to the top 10. Everything stays up for the duration of the event, but it's focused on then the top 10, and you get one vote in that top 10 to determine the sort. And it's $200,000 for the grand prize, 50 for second, 25 for third, and 5 for the rest of the top 10. For the public vote. And then this year we have really expanded the juried prizes. These are more traditional sort of art prizes, but in the context of this massive community engagement, where we have 5 $20,000 juried prizes and $100,000 grand prize juried.
And I'm sure that means an awful lot to so many of these artists. That's some major money.
Yeah, it's simple and people understand it. But really, you know, there's a whole bunch of reasons that people are participating in Art Prize, and for a lot of them, the prize is not actually what they're going after. I mean, obviously everybody would love to win it, mm-hmm. but there is, you can get engagement with so many people here. The Grand Rapids Art Museum saw over 160,000 people come through its doors last year. So there are very few places where you can go and have that sort of traffic, that sort of exposure, and that sort of engagement. And So you can sell work out of that. You can build relationships with a much broader sort of family of supporters as an artist. So, artists are really kind of coming to it with their own sort of ideas and goals and things that they're looking to get out of it. But, you know, the prize is easily understood. It kind of sets the basic ground rules and sets a direction. But a lot of it is just kind of this freewheeling, fun and zany event.
And the idea of having a prize at stake, I would imagine for visitors, they really feel like there's something invested. My vote matters because really comes out of this.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And because everybody has that common platform of the vote, they have an incentive to talk to other people, to try and convince people, to try and educate people. And it's through that curiosity that it engenders and that conversation that comes out of it that, you know, really learning happens. There's only so much you can push on people and tell them what to think and what to memorize. But if you ignite that sort of curious spirit in people and they start to explore their city and wander into places they've never been before, and thinking about art for, you know, first time really, that inevitably changes people. And that's what I'm most kind of excited about. It's really the goal of Art Prize over long term is, what does that do to our culture? How does that change our culture?
And creating that conversation about art. And also, yep. I would suspect if people come as families, then I'm sure there could be the prospect of growing the next generation of art fans.
Yeah, that's actually a great point. I did not think of families, really, when we were coming up with this idea. I mean, we imagined it would be mostly interesting to 20 and 30-somethings, but the extent to which families come down, kids, seniors, but I don't know how many times I've heard from parents talking about their kids and their experience with Art Prize and how it has inspired them to actually take up painting or take up some sort of creative activity. That's really, really, really cool and really humbling to have played a small role in sparking that. I have a very young daughter, and I can't wait to bring her around Art Prize when she's a little bit older and can actually understand what's going on.
Sure.
That's what to do right now, but yeah.
Rick, I want to ask you a little about, there were some headlines this morning about the piece from the Kalamazoo artist Singh called Captivity. The owner of the host business came in and saw an effigy of Saddam Hussein hanging from a noose and said, in essence, thanks but no thanks, because he saw that further installations were going to be involved with rape and bestiality and suicide. And so basically he left the Saddam effigy lying near a dumpster. Could you understand why the host might pull that out of his business?
You know, I don't have all the details of what all the agreements were and everything between the artists and that venue. I mean, the unique thing about Art Prize is that Art Prize does not make any sort of curatorial decisions. We have no filter. We have no screen. If you are 18 and you can find a place to host you in Grand Rapids in this 3-square-mile area and that place registers as a venue with us, You can be a part of Art Prize. So each individual venue owner or manager is in charge of their experience in their space. And, you know, with over 1,500 artists participating in over 150 venues, That's a lot of negotiation. That's a lot of relationship. And that's a lot of particular data and information that we don't have access to intentionally. I mean, there's just no way we could pull it off as the organizers of this event if we were in the midst of every single one of those relationships. So,
yeah.
You know, it's definitely an unfortunate thing. It's not at all what we want to see in terms of how art is being treated and how artists are being treated. But I don't have the full facts to be able to, you know, make any sort of definitive statements on it. But I think it's important to know that this is an artist venue issue, which is part of the model of Art Prize that they are collaborating together, and you know, we'll see as we dig into it more, I guess, what it is. But yeah,
right. I guess I wondered, if you look at what the content of that particular piece was going to be about, I guess, could you see where the public or families might look and go, how is that art? And I know you had a pretty cool quote where you said, hey, you're welcoming, quote, crazy crap, get it in here, let's get conversation started. So I guess just maybe as an art lover and as a dad, my question to you would be, you know, when is crazy crap not art and maybe just crazy crap?
Well, yeah, I mean, the crazy crap quote was, you know, taken somewhat out of context and probably an unfortunate choice of words. But it spoke really to my desire to see just an outpouring of creativity and a wide diversity of kinds of expressions. So it's not really much as much of a judgment call as much as it is that just these sort of breadth and depth of things. So, you know, I'm extremely kind of open-minded on this stuff. I mean, I understand where some people get upset, but at the same time, you know, you're a parent, you can have your radar up and figure out how you want to navigate things. And so I, you know, I'm not in any way some sort of arbiter of what is not art and things like that. I'm not, I mean, there are lots of people that spend a lot of time talking about and debating those things.
Sure.
But our goal with Art Prize was to welcome, you know, as much as possible and frankly, I'm somewhat surprised that it's taken this long to have one of these sort of controversies erupt, because it's a very standard sort of controversy.
Yes.
And, you know, conversation and working through that process is good. At the same time, I mean, it's a little boring. It just whatever. But I think we've done a pretty good job of engaging a lot of people in thinking about, talking about, looking at art.
Based on the photographs on the website at artprize.org, it is spectacular to see throngs and throngs of people that, as you say, may not otherwise have been considering art. Thanks for talking with us. I know it's a busy time for you, and it's been fun talking with you, Rick DeVos. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, what would you do? Let's say you're walking down the street, you turn a corner, and bam, you see a lonely piano just waiting to be played. Well, that could actually happen if you're in downtown Ypsilanti starting today. Corinne Henchelian-Amos created Pianos Round Town 3 years ago. The idea came from London, and cities around the world have joined in. Henchelian Amos is a piano teacher. She got Steinway Piano Gallery on board to lend the pianos. And 8 business owners in Ypsilanti agreed to adopt a piano, putting it outside in front of the store each morning. And don't worry, they schlep them back indoors at night and run and cover them up if it rains. Henchelian Amos says anyone can play at any time.
A lot of people pass by and they just tickle the ivories up and down as they're walking. They don't even stop. And other people will sit down, they'll play boogie boogie, they'll play things that they played as children. And other people will be accomplished pianists like myself, and I'll sit down and I'll play in different pianos and, you know, play Chopin, and then I'll get some clapping. If I played in front of the sidetrack last year and the traffic light was red, so some people heard me over there, you know, from their windows, and then when the piece ended, they were clapping. So it was great.
So what do you think the pianos and spontaneous music, what does it do for the mood of the community?
I don't know. I think it brings them together. But basically, people just can't believe that it's something that's free. Free and fun. Basically, just free and fun.
And Pianos Around Town is going on in downtown Ypsilanti through October 9th. You can find out more online at michiganradio.org. Finally now, a story that I just couldn't wait to share with all of you. A husband starts some huge home renovations on his White Lake Township home, and then he couldn't finish the work. Why? Because Army First Lieutenant Joseph Propotnick was deployed to Afghanistan. That left his wife Melanie with a huge mess until this week, when 25 volunteers from the Farmington Hills Home Depot store turned up, tools in hand, to finish the job. Melanie, he left you with quite a honey-do list.
Oh, you aren't kidding. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you serious? He's like, this is a power washer. All you have to do is just yank this chain. I'm like, what? What? We didn't have a bathroom upstairs, and I had had surgery, and it's a tri-level house. We had sticks in our doors to lock them. He had tried to drill out some holes to put locks on the slide. We had 3 sliding glass doors, and he tried drilling holes to put temporary locks on them that just weren't working. So we had sticks in the doors, a garage door that we couldn't open. So I was trying to prop it up with wood It was tough.
So, Melanie, tell us what happened this week. Some angels wearing Home Depot shirts pull up to your house?
Oh, my gosh. I felt like I won, the lottery. They came in. They volunteered not only to do those things, but they went above and beyond. They are in every room of my house. I have three new doors, a fourth one on the front. They have a garage door on order. I'm going to have a bathroom with a bathtub. It's just unbelievable. And my husband's most favorite thing is they put in a flagpole. So now we have a American flag flying in front of our house.
Melanie, what do you now feel about the way that the public and companies like Home Depot and these volunteers from their Farmington Hills store, how do you now feel about the way that you're being supported, you military families?
I'm beside myself. I've got to tell you, I felt really, really alone and like nobody understood. And because my husband's base unit was 2.5 hours away, I didn't have that closeness of anybody else. And heck, I can't even get someone to let me into traffic. And I just thought nobody understands. And for these people to come out, it feels like they're doing things that my husband would have done for me. And it's absolutely incredible. No. I just want to pay it forward.
Melanie, how long till your husband comes home?
Not till late next spring, if I'm lucky.
Melanie, thanks for talking with us, and it's nice to see that there are angels among us.
There are. Thank you so much.
We want to thank those of you who have emailed and Facebooked us with your comments and with your suggestions. Hearing from you really is important to us, your thoughts about the show and stories and interviews that you'd like to see us do here on Stateside. You can find us on Facebook as Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y, Irish, C-A-N-T-Y. Also at Stateside Radio on Twitter, and of course you can find previous stories and interviews online at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Kyle Norris, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. Tamar Charney is the station's program director, and the director of broadcasting for Michigan Radio is Steve Schramm. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening to Stateside.